Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, and welcome to this new mini-series for GoTo Unscripted called The State of the Art. This series will explore generative AI, of course, but also other emerging trends in platform engineering and security, new practices and new programming languages. I'm Charles Humble. I have about 30 years' experience as a programmer, architect and CTO, and I'm currently working mainly as a freelance consultant, tech journalist, editor and podcaster. I've just published a book for the new stack called Kubernetes at the Edge, and I mention this because during the course of writing it, I found myself reflecting on the fact that during my career, I've seen, I'm going to say, five major shifts in how enterprise software is built and deployed. So the first was the adoption of higher-level languages, things like Java and C# and Visual Basic. The second would be the agile movement. Then we had public cloud, then DevOps and particularly continuous delivery, and also microservices. And each of those ultimately succeeded because, I would argue, they reduce time to value. That's to say, they enable someone in a business to go from having an idea to getting that idea in front of a customer faster and at a lower cost. That combination allows businesses to try more ideas and use the market's response to determine which ones resonate and which ones don't. For all the hype and excitement, it remains to be seen whether generative AI will turn out to be a sixth, though many people are already persuaded that it is. Generative AI certainly holds out the promise of being able to write software faster, but if that's true, how do we avoid unintended consequences, and is that solving a problem we actually have? My guest today, Nathan Harvey, is someone who has thought deeply about this topic. Nathan leads the Dora team at Google Cloud, where he guides organizations in optimizing their software delivery. He leverages Dora's extensive research to help teams enhance developer experience and improve the speed, stability, and efficiency of their software delivery. Nathan is also dedicated to fostering the growth of technical communities such as the Dora Community of Practice and has co-authored several influential Dora reports and contributed to the O'Reilly book, 97 Things Every Cloud Engineer Should Know. He and I met up recently in London at the AI for the Rest of Us conference, where he gave a fantastic keynote called Navigating the Generative AI Revolution in Software Development. Assuming the video of that is out, we'll link to it in the show notes. But that, along with the Dora research that underpins it, is kind of the underlying theme for this show today. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Charles. It's really good to see you. And it was great to see you in London a few weeks back.
Thank you. Yeah, lovely to see you as well. So despite my ridiculously long introduction, I managed to get all the way to the end of it without actually explaining what Dora is. So I'm imagining our listeners and watchers have some idea, but can you give me your kind of description? What is Dora?
Yeah, for sure. Dora is a research program that's been running for well over a decade now. I think we're up to 12 or 13 years, something along those lines. And this research really looks into sort of the metrics and the capabilities and conditions that teams need to really understand how are they doing with software delivery performance, and probably more important than how they're doing, what things can they do to improve that software delivery performance? And as you said, software delivery performance is sort of, it's sort of the crux of being able to deliver software to your users so that you can test out, is this a feature that our customers want, that the market wants? And the more we're able to ship features, the more we're able to ship change, the better off we are in terms of being able to make decisions about what's the right thing to do for our customers and for our users. So this research program each year runs an annual survey. This survey is an anonymous survey that goes out to organizations around the world. And we're very lucky to get responses from organizations of every shape and size in every industry vertical. In fact, in 2025, we received nearly 5,000 survey responses to our survey. We complement this survey data with some qualitative data as well. So in addition to having these 5,000 or so survey responses, we also had about 100 hours worth of qualitative data, interviews that our qualitative researchers did one-on-one with practitioners, with leaders, and so forth. Now, the participants of this survey and of our research program, many of them are developers of some sort, certainly technical practitioners, whether that's someone who identifies as a DevOps engineer or a software engineer, like kind of across the board. But we also hear from folks like product managers, team leads, engineering managers, CTOs, leadership, and so forth. So it's a pretty broad perspective that we get each year, which really helps inform that research.
How did you get involved in DORA? What was your kind of starting point for that?
Sure. My starting point, actually, when the research program first launched, it launched out of a company at the time, was called Puppet Labs, and they ran the first ever State of DevOps survey. At the time, I was a practitioner. I was working in an organization where we were, you know, starting to adopt DevOps practices. We were moving from the data center into the cloud. I was leading a web operations team. And so I participated in the first survey. And so in that way, I like to say that I've been involved since the very beginning. A few years on, I joined a company called Chef, where some of the lead researchers, in particular, Dr. Nicole Forsgren and Jez Humble, were both working at the same time that I was working at Chef. While they were there, they were continuing this DORA research program. They eventually left Chef and then founded a company called DORA. I stayed at Chef until I joined Google, which shortly after I joined, actually acquired DORA. So Nicole and Jez and I got to work together again. They've all since moved on to other things, and I've taken over leading the DORA program for the last 4 or 5 years or so.
So I guess a question that comes up for me is how neutral the research actually is. So obviously this is now a Google project, Google has Google Cloud, and I'm aware, you know, you obviously I read the reports every year, you don't promote Google Cloud, but Google has also been pushing AI very heavily and is kind of an AI first company in many respects. I mean, I would perhaps say that they were one of the first companies to really sort of invest in AI as a set of technologies. So given all of that, how much does Google's corporate agenda influence what DORA covers, what it writes about, if at all?
Yeah, that's it's a completely fair question. I would say first and foremost that the research has always been program and platform agnostic. We aren't asking about specific technologies, but we are asking about those capabilities and conditions that high-performing teams have. Now, of course, I'm employed by Google, as are the researchers and a large number of people that are contributing to DORA. But we do sort of maintain a fair bit of independence in terms of what we research and so forth. DORA has always been very interested in understanding what are the trends within industry and really trying to spot those trends and follow them as they evolve. As an example, you know, DORA started right at the early stages of cloud. And so DORA had a lot of research into this idea of like, is the cloud and public cloud going to help organizations? And through that research, we were able to identify that it wasn't whether or not you were using cloud, but rather how you were using cloud. And really, we've evolved that sort of thinking into this idea of flexible infrastructure. So when you have flexible infrastructure, teams tend to do better than teams without that flexible infrastructure. And of course, one of the ways to get flexible infrastructure is through public cloud. So we do maintain a good bit of independence. It is true that this year's report, the 2025 report, is called the State of AI-Assisted Software Development. And this certainly, we live and work within Google, so we hear and our colleagues are pushing a lot of AI and advancing the state of the art there. At the same time, so many people across the industry are doing this. And so from a DORA perspective, we really want to understand how is AI impacting software delivery? How is it impacting these teams? And so this is actually the third year that we've looked into AI, progressively going deeper and deeper. So it would sort of be false to say that there's absolutely no influence. There's certainly influence, but we do remain fairly independent from Google Cloud.
So before we get into the AI report itself, or reports, because there have been two of them now, I want to ask you a sort of more general question, which is something that I've seen a bit in my own consulting practice, and it has to do with the four DORA metrics. Mm-hmm. So these are, I think, quite well understood. Obviously, this particular question is somewhat anecdotal, but I'm interested to know if it's something you see as well. So I've had a couple of clients who were having, you know, sort of team performance issues. They'd adopted the DORA metrics, but they then seemed very unclear as to what improvements to make, like where to focus. So they could see what the metrics were telling them, if you like, but they weren't then doing the next bit, which was sort of making a hypothesis and doing some sort of validation, if you like. And obviously there's a lot that's very context specific here, because if you're a young team, you probably want to be looking at different things to if you're, I don't know, a huge team in a bank or something. But I wondered if you could give, first of all, is that something you've seen yourself? And if it is, do you have any kind of general advice for people?
Yes, it is certainly something that I've seen. And in fact, this is something that over time, the research, you know, has continued to evolve. And so while you mentioned the four DORA metrics, I'm really sort of excited, maybe. I don't know if excited is the right term, but I'm happy to share that four have actually become five. In fact, for the past 2 years, we've looked at five different metrics for software delivery performance. As before, these metrics fall under two sort of high-level factors, throughput and stability. On the throughput side, we have three measures that we look at. Your lead time for changes, so how long does it take for a change to go from committed to running in the production environment. Your deployment frequency, how frequently are you updating that production environment. And your failed deployment recovery time, so when something goes off on a deployment, how long does it take you to get that deployment back to working? And on the stability side, we have your change failure rate. And this is a measure of how many deployments require immediate intervention. Something has gone wrong. We need humans to intervene on these deployments. And then finally, our fifth metric, and this is the newest one, is your deployment rework rate. So when you make a deployment and have to rework that deployment in some way, whether that's, you know, maybe you're doing an unplanned deployment to recover from some failure, that would be considered rework. And so that those measures, those five measures taken together, there's a couple of really interesting things about them. First, they can be used for any type of software that you're shipping into production or making available to your users. And second, we oftentimes think of throughput and stability as trade-offs of one another, but over the years, over the decade plus of this research, we've shown that they aren't trade-offs, but rather they tend to move together. So teams are either have fast throughput and high stability, or low throughput and low stability. Of course, we probably want the former, not the latter. We want to be able to move fast and move in a way that is very stable. Now, when it comes to your question, how do we go from really understanding what these metrics are measuring? What do we do with this once we understand exactly how things are going? Well, this is another thing where it's really important to think about these metrics kind of serve two purposes. One purpose is that these metrics in our data and our research, we've shown them to be leading indicators for the outcomes that teams care about. Things like organizational performance and well-being for the people on your team. But these metrics are also lagging indicators for the capabilities and conditions that you have on your team. For example, you need a climate for learning. You need fast flow and fast feedback in order to improve those metrics. Now, with the DORA model, and through our research, we investigate those capabilities over time to really understand how do those capabilities relate to software delivery performance. And we find things like documentation quality, streamlining change approval processes, continuous integration, all of these contribute to better software delivery performance. So the thing that I really encourage teams to do is to use the DORA model of these capabilities together with these metrics, use the metrics to get a baseline for how is your team doing today? And then take into consideration the capabilities and kind of run a quick assessment across those capabilities. Where does our team have a weakness or an opportunity to improve? And then go run an experiment. You know, take DORA's findings as your hypotheses. A good example of this, DORA has found that as you get better at continuous integration, that improves software delivery performance. So now maybe your team isn't practicing continuous integration or has opportunities to improve it. Sit down and write that hypothesis. We believe that by improving our continuous integration practices, we're going to see software delivery performance improved as measured by these metrics. And as a result of that, we're going to see happier customers. Now that you've got that hypothesis written down, you can go back and start improving or changing how you do continuous integration. And you can validate that hypothesis. You can validate our research in the context of your team. And I think that's what's super important, is that you're taking our research and contextualizing it for your team within your organization.
That's a fantastic answer. Thank you. So it would be remiss of me not to start diving into the AI stuff at this point. So there was a rather headline-grabbing finding in the 2024 DORA report, which basically said that the more AI was used, the worse both stability and throughput became. So more rollbacks and so on. And obviously, right. That's essentially what we've been optimizing for most of the last 20 years. So it's not a great finding. Now, I should say the 2025 report kind of suggests the opposite. But I was interested if you could maybe give us some context there. Talk about that finding a bit and what it's telling us.
Yeah, for sure. So in 2024, we did see, in fact, that as teams are adopting more AI, both throughput and stability were falling off. There was a small reversal in 2025 as teams are adapting to AI. We see throughput is actually improving as you use more AI, but we still see high levels of instability when you use more AI. So when I think about this, I think there are probably a couple of different explanations. The first explanation, I think, is probably the simplest, and that is we're using a new tool and using new processes as we're developing software. Anytime you introduce something new, we should expect to see some fall off in performance as we learn how to adapt to this new technology or this new way of working and how that might improve overall performance. But I think the other thing that is really interesting here, and another hypothesis that I have, is that as an industry, one of the biggest ways and first ways that we've used AI within software development is to use it to generate more code. Now, when you think about the entire software delivery process, everything from having an idea to getting that idea into customers in a tangible way within your systems, it is rarely the case that writing code is the bottleneck in that process. And yet we put a lot of emphasis on AI to help us generate or author more code. Your bottlenecks are usually downstream from that. And we kind of know that in any system that you're working in, if there's a flow of work that goes through that system, somewhere there's a constraint. And if you make an improvement that's not at that constraint, you're probably not improving the overall system performance. In fact, you may be harming it. And so in this case, in 2024, I think that's what we were seeing, generating more code and generating code faster. But the mechanisms, the feedback mechanisms, the flow mechanisms that allow that code to get into the production environment hadn't adapted, weren't able to sort of account for or handle this new onslaught of additional code. I think that's a big reason why we're seeing that. And we're starting to see, as I mentioned, some of that change now in 2025.
Yeah, I that's kind of very much changed with my thinking on it. And actually, you know, I said at the top of this show, I've been in this industry a long time. And I feel like we've beaten this to death. Like we've been over and over and over again, the idea that typing is the hard bit. And it's not, which is why, you know, measuring lines of code or GitHub commits or any of those things are just terrible, terrible metrics. Because, you know, as an indicator of performance, A, they're very gameable, but B, they don't really tell you anything. And it kind of feels a bit to me like we're going round another of these leaps of optimizing individual developer productivity, but doing that at the expense of the system as a whole, which seems to me to be, you know, I'd have thought by now we'd have got away from that, but apparently not.
Yeah. And I think that systems thinking is so, so important. I mean, you could lay the same criticism against those software delivery performance metrics. That's not actually telling you whether or not you're delivering business value or customer value. And right. I would agree with that, but our research has shown that as you improve software delivery performance, you're also improving those outcomes that matter. And so I challenge every organization that's using these to put those software delivery metrics side by side with the business metrics that they actually care about. You should see them moving together. And when you don't, that's cause for investigation, cause for inquiry. Let's go figure out why these aren't moving together and see what can we do to change that.
So in the most recent report, and also I saw you emphasize this in your keynote as well, you talked about AI as an amplifier. So can you unpick that a bit for me? What does that mean?
Yeah, I really think that AI and what we're kind of seeing in the data is that it amplifies sort of the underlying systems that exist within organizations. Organizations where software changes can flow easily and there's good feedback mechanisms along the way, AI tends to amplify or speed up that flow of software. In contrast to that, where you have organizations that are disconnected or there's a lot of friction in getting changes through your system, AI tends to sort of highlight, here's where the pains are. I'll give you a really good example, like a crisp example that we've actually been researching for a couple of years. If we go back to 2023, which was really one of the first years that we investigated AI, one of the findings that we had in that year was that the code review process was often a bottleneck for teams. And this was with or without AI. But we found that those teams that had faster code reviews had about 50% better software delivery performance. It was kind of a one-to-one mapping. As you improve code review process and speed, software delivery speed also improved. Now, inject AI to help us create more code. If we haven't addressed code review as a bottleneck, we're now sending more code into that code review process. And so that's going to feel even more painful. That's a great example of AI amplifying some pain that we have there. The code reviews are actually going to take longer. They're going to get slower because we're generating more code. Contrast that with somewhere, an organization that has a good, high quality, fast feedback process when it comes to code reviews, and AI is going to help us improve that. And in fact, what this may lead you to as an organization is understanding that maybe we'll get more benefit out of using AI in the code review process than we will in the code authoring process. That's one of the sort of ways that you can contextualize these findings within your own team.
What would you say are some of the things that technology organizations need to get in place before they try and scale an AI adoption?
Yeah, this is a really good question. And it's one of the sort of research questions that we had. Like I said earlier in our research program, we looked at the cloud, and it wasn't that you were using the cloud, but rather how you were using the cloud. So this year, we wanted to understand what capabilities really enhance AI adoption and the impacts that AI adoption is having. And so we investigated a bunch of capabilities based on the hypotheses that we had, but we narrowed it down to about 7 capabilities, which we are now calling the DORA AI capabilities model. These capabilities and conditions, when mapped together with heavy AI adoption, these capabilities amplify that adoption on the outcomes that you care about, things like reducing friction, things like better product performance, and so forth. So the 7 capabilities that we have, and I'm going to do this off the top of my head, so forgive me if I stutter here just a little bit, but the first is a clear and communicated stance on how and where and when AI can be used within your organization. This is really important to have. The others are having a good data ecosystem, kind of following the old adage, you know, garbage in, garbage out. The AI has to have access to good data. That data has to be well connected, which leads us to our third, which is AI having access to that internal data. Fourth, we have strong version control practices. You know, if AI is generating a lot of code for us, we probably want to be checking in those changes very frequently so that when something goes wrong, we can rely on the rollback capabilities that version control gives us. Another is, again, sort of a classic thing that we've learned within software engineering, and that's working in smaller batches. Instead of taking on a big change, what we do as engineers is we take large changes and break them down into small changes. Doing so helps the AI have even stronger impact on the things that we care about. Number 6 is a user-centric focus. We aren't using AI for AI. We're using it to support the needs of our users, to help delight them. And then finally, having a good internal platform in place, we see that, again, as an amplifier of the AI adoption that happens within an organization. So those are the 7 DORA AI capabilities. We expect that those are going to change over time, just like our 4 software delivery metrics are now 5. We expect that these capabilities are going to change and evolve over time as we learn more, both as an industry and as a research program.
And it's worth saying, I think, obviously some of those are very software specific, but I think some of those apply equally well outside of a software organization. I mean, having a clear AI policy, having a clear AI stance is something that every organization that's adopting AI in any context, that's a thing that you need in place. I'm thrilled to see this. It's sort of validating a lot of ideas that I think people have had and giving real weight to them. And I think that's tremendous.
That's awesome. Yeah. And to your point, you know, when we look at AI adoption, we are looking at it beyond just using AI to write code or within the software delivery practice. We are really looking at AI across the organization.
So earlier on, you mentioned the importance of documentation, and this has been a lovely thing for me because it's been a drum I've beaten for most of my career. And I have to tell you, at times it's a lonely drum. So, you know, having the last 4 years being able to point to Dora and go, look, it turns out that documentation quality does actually have an influence on software delivery performance has been nice. In the most recent report, you say that AI adoption helps improve that. And I'm going to be honest and say I find that quite surprising. So as an editor, all of my experience has kind of been the opposite.
Sure.
Like anything that's very obviously written by a large language model is just painfully difficult to edit. And it's partly because it breaks your heuristics. You know, you can normally tell when a human being is going off the edge of their knowledge and, oh, I need to fact check that a bit more. You know, like, well, as with a large language model, it's super hard to tell. But anyway, can you help my understanding of this? How are people using AI for documentation? How's that? Why is it helping? Why is it improving quality?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And documentation, like you said, is something that we've looked at for many, many years. We have a saying around Dora, documentation is like sunshine. It really unlocks a lot of the things that matter to technology-driven organizations and technology-driven teams. And you're also correct that in 2024 in particular, what we saw was that as you increase your usage of AI, documentation quality tends to improve. Now, it's really interesting because we aren't asking about documentation quantity, right? You don't measure documentation by the pound. That's not what matters. We do ask, you know, survey questions that get to the quality of the documentation. Survey questions like, if there's a problem, do you reach for the documentation? That's a good indicator that you have good quality documentation. And while we saw documentation, like those quality signals improving as you use more AI, we have a couple of hypotheses around those. First and foremost, maybe you're using AI to generate more documentation and perhaps it is helping improve some of the documentation quality. I'll speak from personal experience. I pointed an LLM at a project that I was working with that had no getting started documentation. I said, write a doc that helps a developer get started in this particular project. And it did a fair job. Certainly, it required some editing. But the reality is, I wasn't going to write that from scratch myself. Even though maybe I should have, it's not fun to sit and look at a blank piece of paper. I'd much rather take even some poorly written words and clean those up, like correct that and make it better. So I think that definitely helps. You find more engineers are putting a little bit more time into documentation and leaning on the crutch that is the LLMs. But I think there's another thing that we sometimes discount. One of the things that I think LLMs are pretty good at is summarizing existing documentation, right? I can hand it, I don't know, the Dora report from this year is 142 pages long. I don't have time to read that. Let me hand it to an LLM and get a summary of that and then decide which parts I want to go and read. LLMs are very good at summarizing documentation, summarizing content and giving us the prescient points. So while I think that LLMs and AI may be improving the documentation quality, they may also be helping teams get more utility out of their existing documentation. So perhaps you have documentation that's spread around your organization or maybe even conflicting documentation. You can feed all of that to an LLM and try to draw some of the key points out of that. And maybe that gives you better utility out of those existing docs. And so I think there's a couple of different ways to look at it. Is it improving the quality of our documentation or helping us get more utility out of existing documentation? The answer is likely yes to both, or at least it's impacting both and hopefully improving that. But again, you know, we in Dora, we look at the world and we see these patterns that are emerging. Everything comes back to the context within your own team. And so I would encourage you, you know, again, take our hypotheses, take our findings as findings that we see, but you have to prove them out within your own context as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to kind of move on to some of the more human aspects of this. So one of those is trust. and how much you trust the output of an LLM. And we've sort of touched on this a bit, but with our documentation, you know, I think it's entirely possible to, in fact, I've had this exact experience. I've asked an LLM to document an API, and it's produced documentation which includes calls and features that don't exist at all. Mm-hmm. I've also done, you know, I tried an experiment where I'd written a news report and I pointed it to a press release and asked it what I'd missed. And it gave me six things that it claimed I'd missed, and I couldn't find any of them in the report. And I had that sort of typical, you know, I can't find this. Oh, yes. Terribly sorry, I made a mistake type response, right? So I think, I guess what I'm getting at is there is this broad question of how much do you, I mean, maybe I'm just using it wrong, but how much do you trust the technology? And what, again, what is that? What does that look like?
Yeah, this is a really fascinating question because, you know, for 2 years in a row, we've seen individuals reporting feeling more productive when they're using AI, that it's improving the underlying quality of their code base and their documentation. And we ask about trust in both 2024 and 2025. We kind of see a trust paradox, if you will, where we see a significant portion of people that have very little or no trust in the output of AI. In fact, in 2025, it was 30% of our respondents had little or no trust in the output of AI. On the other hand, there were 4%, I believe, that trusted the output of AI a great deal. I personally believe that you should not trust the output of AI a great deal. You should not trust it 0% either, right? They're both extremes, I think, are wrong in 2025, right? We're recording this in October of 2025. I think either extreme is incorrect. I think this trust paradox really reminds us of some of the things that we've seen throughout our research and both of us have experienced throughout our careers. This idea of getting fast feedback on whether it's software changes or a document that you're reading, you have to be able to get that feedback very quickly, and you want that feedback to be very good feedback. And so this does sort of lean us in towards this idea that we want to have those feedback, strong feedback mechanisms in place so that when we do generate AI or we do generate something with AI, we can test that. Is this valid? Is it truthful? Is it comprehensive? Is it doing the things that I like and so forth? The other thing, of course, that we see, and this I don't think is a surprise in our data, is that as you use more AI, you tend to trust it more. Sort of usage and trust are kind of a virtuous cycle, right? You use a thing more, you trust it more. Because you trust it more, you're more likely to use it. Because you're using it more, you're more likely to trust it, right? But I think this also goes back to this idea that trust doesn't necessarily mean that it's accurate, right? Trusting the output of AI doesn't mean that the output of AI is accurate. It means that trust really is about meeting my expectations. I expect you're going to give me mediocre responses, and I continue to use you, and I continue to get mediocre responses. That improves my trust in you. Now, that's not to say that AI always gives you mediocre responses. I'm not saying that. But, you know, as it meets your expectations over and over again across time, that, I think, is the thing that really builds trust. So I know when I ask it a question, if I ask it a question like find six things that are missing, it's going to find six things that are missing. Whether or not it's valid, whether or not that's true, I asked it for six things, it's going to give me six things. That's sort of the nature of AI today. It wants to please the user. It wants to answer the question that was asked. It's not as well-tuned at saying, you know what? You've done a great job here, Charles. I can't find anything that's missing.
Right. Yes. There's another question that I have here, and it's to do with, it's sort of to do with ownership. And this is we'd probably do a whole podcast on this question, to be honest. But I suppose what I'm getting at is, does AI change our relationship with the code? So if we've written some code with an AI assistant, who owns that code? Who is responsible for that code? What is our relationship to that code?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. In fact, we looked into that a little bit and reported some of our findings in the 2025 report. There's a section there called the Sociocognitive Impact of AI on Professional Developers. And we looked at the relationship that developers have with their code when using AI in terms of things like authentic pride, the meaning of the work, the need for cognition, an existential connection to that code. To your point, the psychological ownership over that code and skill reprioritization. What skills are teams prioritizing? I would say that we are very early in this evolution and the adoption of AI. So there wasn't a whole lot of like rich, meaningful data that we found. We found that, you know, they're relatively close to one another, whether you're using AI or not. Things like the code I wrote is my own. Do you agree or disagree with that? Usually they're pretty close to one another. So I think we're early days in answering some of these questions. And in fact, as individuals, sort of internalizing how we feel about some of those questions.
Yeah. There's another sort of human question here, and it's an obvious question in a way, but it's this idea that AI devalues skills. So, for example, you know, do I need a UX specialist? My AI can build the UX for me. Or do I need an SRE team? Surely I can automate that work away. Or do I need a documentation specialist if the AI can generate the documentation? And a lot of conversations I'm having with people, I mean, obviously a lot of people are genuinely, I would say, grieving. Like a lot of people are genuinely feeling like they've spent a whole bunch of time developing a set of skills that are no longer relevant. And not just within IT, but much, much broader than that. I mean, you know, I have some keyboards to my right here. I'm a not terribly successful musician in my spare time. And I know lots of people who are like media composers, so who write music for TV and games and films. And a lot of them are seeing, you know, work being taken away from them, basically. I'm just, again, it's just a sort of contextualizing question, but is that something we just have to accept? You know, a bit like the Industrial Revolution or whatever, you know, like some jobs are going to go away. Or do you think there is still a role within our industry? Do you think there's still a role for specialist skills?
I think it's really interesting. I think that AI does open up opportunities for people to pick up new skills and become kind of novices at those. And my biggest concern, honestly, is that AI enables this devaluing of the skills that other experts have. I think, you know, documentation writing, right? Technical writing. Yeah, AI can generate code for me. Do I need technical writers anymore? Well, if I'm a software engineer asking that, just turn that question around and think, do I need software engineers anymore? The answer, if you're a software engineer using AI, the answer is obviously yes, we continue to need software engineers. So I think it's really important that you consider that technical writing as the example here. Do you have expertise in that skill? You don't. So maybe AI has made you a novice technical writer, but you're not an expert. Certainly not today. And leaning on that expertise that an expert technical writer brings to the team, I think is really important. So I think on the one hand, AI is sort of democratizing a bunch of different skills. You know, a product manager can very quickly build a prototype that maybe they couldn't build before. It's pretty clear to anyone that looks at it that that prototype is not ready for production, right? And so it is really important that we, as we think about doing some of the things that other experts do, I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind. One, you might do those because you've always wanted to and just haven't felt that you have the skills to do so. And just doing that for fun, there's a lot of value in that, right? I can now go and compose some music that I couldn't compose before. And that's fun. But recognize that what the work that you're doing is not expert work. And so treat it as such, right? And maybe it helps you communicate better with those experts because now you've learned a little bit more of the skill. But I think it's really important to remember and recognize that we still need the expertise, even if the AI allows us to sort of scratch the surface in that field.
I think that's a fantastic answer. Thank you. Dora is very geared to kind of where we are today. So, you know, like it's basically like a snapshot of here is the state of the art right now. So I'm going to ask you a desperately unfair question, which is what do you think the future looks like? You know, where are we going with this AI stuff?
Yeah, it is, I mean, you've raised a great point. Dora does a snapshot of the industry year on year. We do continuing research throughout the year, but Dora, just like most of us, Charles, is pretty bad at predicting the future. So Dora, Dora tends to stay out of that game. But I do think we're seeing some echoes here of things of the past. And you mentioned these at the top of the show, right? Whether it's agile or DevOps or the cloud. And in all of these changes, in order for them really to stick, I think there's a couple of things that we should keep in mind that we've learned from the past, and we should probably expect these patterns to repeat in the future. One that Dora has talked about a number of times is sort of the J curve of transformation. So that J curve of transformation is really when we have a new technology or a new way of working, we tend to initially see a dip in productivity. And then eventually that dip sort of bottoms out and we start to see real changes or real improvements based on adopting that new technology or that new way of working. So I expect that we're going to see that. And our goal within Dora is really to understand, how do you get out of that dip? What are teams doing that's different than other teams that helps them get on the upward trajectory? And that's part of why we have the Dora AI capabilities model. So I think that's one important thing to keep in mind. And the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that we have to think systemically. Think about the entire systems that we're working within and recognize that every single one of us, we are working in a complex system. This complex system has emergent behaviors. There's people involved and technology involved, and they all interact and respond differently to stimulus. And so we need to just understand that and know that it's going to take sort of, I guess we can't get rid of critical thinking skills. We can't get rid of, you know, experimentation. Experimentation is one of the best ways for us to continue to learn how and where to best use these technologies. So I think we're going to continue to see some echoes of what we've seen in the past. I do think that AI is here to stay. And one piece of evidence that I'll bring to that, in 2024, we asked, how is your organization reprioritizing AI? And it was very clear that almost every organization is prioritizing AI from the top down. We also see broad adoption at the practitioner level. So that it's this top down and grassroots, I think, that provides a really strong signal here that this is here to stay. It probably in 5 years won't look like it looks today, but we will still be talking about AI, or maybe we'll stop talking about it because it's just the way that we do work.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Do you think, you mentioned you've now got another metric in the kind of standard set of metrics and the capability model. But do you think that those core Dora metrics, do you think they will need to change or evolve because the practice of building software is changing?
I think what we will see is a continuing evolution of the capabilities that drive those software delivery performance metrics. Dora has always had a sort of a center of gravity, I like to call it, around software delivery. And I do think that in the future, it will still matter how often and how safely a team can deliver new functionality, new changes to an application. I do believe that, you know, as Dave Farley says all the time, one of the measures of quality of an application, a software application, is our ability to change it. And so we always need a way to measure that ability to change. And I think that the software delivery performance metrics are a pretty good way of looking at that. Now, will they change over time? Maybe. If you'd asked us 5 or 6 years ago, we probably would have said the four are perfect and we don't need to change them. We probably wouldn't have said that. But we see that, you know, the science is always evolving, right? So today we have 5, whereas a few years ago we had 4. So I think that they may continue to evolve, although I do think that they're durable enough that we can stick with these and get a lot of good utility out of these for years to come.
Fantastic. My final question would be, if team leaders are looking to integrate AI into their processes now, where do you recommend they start, or what do you recommend that they do?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of different options here, and we talk about these a little bit in the report as well. The first option is really think about adapting your current systems to take advantage of AI. And I think one of the best ways to adapt your current systems is to make sure that you understand your current systems, or to gain a better understanding of them. And one of the best practices that I've seen and utilized over time is value stream mapping. If you get together with a cross-functional team and really map out, what does it take to go from an idea all the way through to a thank you from a customer? How does that information flow through your organization? Where are all of the handoffs? Where are the friction points? Identifying those friction points can give you a pointer into where might we inject some AI, or more generally, think about how do we do that thing differently, with or without AI. But having a value stream map and going through, importantly, the mapping exercise. It's the mapping that's more important than the artifact of the map to really help collectively us understand our systems. So I think that's one thing. Adapt your systems with AI. And then the other thing is to start evolving our systems and thinking in terms of AI native. And I think we're so early in this AI journey that it's hard to imagine what does AI native software delivery look like? What is AI native building an application from scratch and managing that application over its lifetime? What does that look or feel like? I think, like I said, it's very early, but this is another way that we can start thinking about how do we best leverage AI. Today, I would say that the general physics of software delivery haven't actually changed, right? We still have to write code. We've got to validate that code. We've got to get that code approved and ship it off to production, where we're then going to monitor that code and so forth. Is that going to change in an AI native way? I don't know. It certainly hasn't today, but let's all go figure that out together.
Fantastic. Nathan, thank you so much for joining me today on GoTo Unscripted.
Thank you so much, Charles. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.